This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thanks for joining us on our Main Street today all across the state of North Dakota. And today we're going to begin our show focusing on food. It's a major industry in our state and a very important educational subject at our land-grant university, North Dakota State University. Our Bill Thomas, who's director of radio here at Prairie Public, attended a big conference, the fourth annual conference on food for health, earlier this week at NDSU. And Bill, you took in a lot of sessions.
Yes, and talked to a lot of people. And when I first got there, I just walked up to a person to ask her why she was at this conference, to get a sense of what people were there for. Her name was Bibian Cummings. She's a PhD student in natural resource management. She's studying, working on a project about natural remedies for diseases, big interest in public health. And here's what she had to say about why she was here.
I guess the topic of the conference, which focuses on food security, public health solutions, and sustainability. So, and most of the topics were really interesting. I was able to find out that there's more, even more interest in growing organic food, that is healthy food, and then even interest in small-scale farming. So there's, and then connecting farming to health in relation to solving most of the chronic diseases. So I think the major thing I like about the project is the connection between health and agriculture, the food we eat.
Well, food is an international topic, and obviously it draws a lot of people with a lot of diverse interests in the science of food. So I suspect there are some pretty deep dives into this.
Yes, there absolutely were. A lot of the focus of the conference was on things that are emerging into popular culture, some of these what they call micronutrients and aspects. And I loved some of the titles of these talks. They have this sort of odd academic poetry. Effect of the free and bound phenolic fraction from a Peruvian purple corn accession on proliferation of probiotic lactic acid bacteria. That was presented by a researcher from Peru. And one of my favorite ones by a Canadian researcher, the role of cicoisolericyresinol diglucoside on oxidative stress and cardiac remodeling. That's about a micronutrient that's in foods and how it affects heart health. But I love the way they say that stuff.
Now, the conference organizer is Kalita Shetty, and he's obviously been interested in a wide range of information to share with a lot of people.
Yes, and I had a good conversation with him about the conference. He starts off talking about these very micronutrients.
In the sense, food provides us micronutrients and micronutrients. But those have been coming from a narrow range of crops. And those are still necessary, range of crops. But we need to diversify them both in terms of quality and resilience for health needs. Because from the narrow choice, the abundance of micronutrients in a sedentary lifestyle is leading to a lot of the non-communicable chronic disease, which are on the rise. Go ahead.
I'm curious of there's been a whole range of presentations here. What are some of the ones that have been most interesting to you?
Oh, the most interesting is the incredible depth of knowledge that's emerging on the nutrient components beyond the macronutrients and micronutrients, and what functional or biological benefits they have, and why we need these other components that we have not considered. So as we look at this non-communicable chronic disease, we may have bred them out in our current food system. And so as we bring diversity, most of the presentations that we have from really well-known international experts is showing that those components have much deeper relevance, and they are showing us very in-depth scientific perspective on it. Yes.
So this is getting into a very, as you say, in-depth biochemical analysis of the food and how it works in the body, right?
Correct. So where we are trying to bridge is, one hand, we have production and building the production and the from soil health to all the way to processing. But beyond that, what happens when it reaches about, you know, in our body? So we're getting a much deeper understanding of it. So a lot of the presentations have covered that. But also, that's not the only coverage. We want to bring the full scale, and that's why we have the various communities. So we want all the voices heard, you know, from our commodity groups to our growers, small growers to large growers, consumers, then the indigenous community. And so we want all perspectives, in a way, to bring them here.
And how... Where are the important points of intersection, and are there conflict and harmony? And
yeah, there's always going to be differences in thoughts. So our goal is to harmonize, and so that's a primary driver. So we want all thoughts heard, and in the end, we have to look at the challenges globally. We are part of the world, and the Great Plains have abundance. Opportunity. So it's one of the few places in the world where we have such incredible diversity of food crops, very rich land. And if we get our understanding together, so with, even with these with climate change challenges, we are one of the few spots where we have will have surplus. And if the surplus is and its abundance and its diversity can be built, it can also be built for resilience to the climate change, but also more equally important, it can the diversity can help the quality that we need for health. So that's the Food for Health conference is driving that. So our goal is to bring all the experts, our local participants, and then how do we give our growers more capacity to add value to our crops? So that it's also a very good economic driver for the region. But at the same time, we are part of the world, and then we support, you know, the resilience of the world as a whole, while we also mutually benefit from it.
Yeah. And so who comes to the conference? Who are your attendees?
Our attendees, we have international experts from many countries, Costa Rica, of course, our neighbors up in Canada from Manitoba, then Ontario, then our states around here, South Dakota, Minnesota. Then we have state partners from Alabama, South Carolina. Some of them are collaborators on different projects. And then several international participants, India, Nigeria, Costa Rica, Peru. In the past, we've had from Korea, Japan. So this is our fourth conference. So we're going to build on that. And that also gives us the network into other countries. So there our function is two things. One is how the capacity of this diverse crop and food system can be of value to the world and to our farmers here. And second, we have a great institution in NDSU, and so where ag is a very good, important component. So the strength of ag can be an important ambassador in mutual research collaborations. And then when we have this mutual support, they will be our partners in building our scientific collaboration, but also ultimately where we export to, right? So that mutual dependency is good. Mm-hmm. We are part of the world, and it helps our economic system, but also we help the world as well from the surplus that we have.
Yes, and I know many farmers of small and large size are proud of the fact that that we are able to help feed so many people from this area. And is this area as an ecological area, a cultural area, and an area of dominated largely by large industrial farming?
Right.
So how does this fit into this kind of global
Very good. So here we are not trying to bias one or the other. So our foundational crops, whether we build it in large systems or small system, diversity is still important. And we in the Great Plains have more than 40 crops in commercial production. That's very, I think after California, we have this amazing diversity, particularly in the many of these grains, the legumes, the grains, wheats, different types of wheats. So we have a long list, a good list. And so that diversity is important. And how both our large farms and small farms are equally important. So we have Minnesota and our growing edamame or black soybean into export markets. So they are important. And so therefore we don't want to bias one or the other. We want to try and sustain all our citizens. And so you can see we have from the full spectrum. And also we're interested in the indigenous communities who have had many layers of challenges from history, and not trying to, look at the negatives of it, but with empathy. So from an empathetic point of view, I feel we have responsibility to look at the indigenous food and what bearing it had on the well-being of our indigenous communities. And if science now can help to sustain some of that, those roots of those cultural framework for the indigenous people, and if we can also benefit from it, it's tremendous, I think. And so we even have an open forum for looking at the challenges of the indigenous community. So in that sense, we want to have an open mind to welcome all.
Sounds like Kalita Shetty is talking about what is old is new again.
Well, absolutely. And we're going to take a break, I know. But when we come back, we will hear about work that's going on that was presented at the conference about recovering almost lost traditional indigenous foods.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us today. And Bill Thomas, our director of radio, is talking about the fourth annual conference on food for health, which was held earlier this week at NDSU. And you went back to your African PhD student, didn't you, to see how she was doing?
I asked her what was one of the most interesting sessions that she'd been to, and here's what she said.
I like the food sovereignty aspect of it, especially the Native Americans and how they're trying to grow more native food with native seeds. And then this upcoming one, another reason is there's a diversity, bringing different cultures together and even seeing their perspective about farming and growing some other foods, and then especially the Native American, they're going to talk about the indigenous seeds and the process they are taking towards growing indigenous food and preparing for food sovereignty.
Well, people have been anxious to eat for a very long time, and we can learn some things from those efforts?
Well, the next person we'll hear from, Robert Schimek, he works at the White Earth Land Recovery Project, and he talked a lot about corn, but he gets more excited later when we get into beans, and talked about working with people, for example, from Ontario, trading seeds, talking about climate and growing seasons and how a lot of the seeds from around here have very short growing seasons, and that's important in time of climate change and looking at the resilience. And he talked a lot about the process of trying to help other people to go through this sort of recovery of heritage.
Well, you know, there's that old parable about, you know, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach him how to fish, you know, and, you know, they take care of themselves for a lifetime. You gotta start somewhere with this stuff and start with what's easy and then refine it and hone it and, you know, keep providing the support for not only that type of food production, you know, on the family or the very local level, but also how do we orchestrate this thing so that those who can't grow for whatever reason, you know, also get part of the bounty of this earth. And, you know, we've heard the term often, food is medicine. When we look at that word medicine in our Ojibwe language, you know, the word we use is mushkiki. You know, and what that translates to is strength from the earth. So that's kind of the foundation for all of it. Yeah, it's health, it's nutrition, but it starts somewhere, and a lot of that has to do with caring for the earth in a manner that's consistent with our values, ethics, and principles as indigenous people here in this Western Great Lakes region.
Again, this is Robert Schimek from the White Earth Land Recovery Project at NDSU's Food and Health Conference. I asked him how you went about recovering older lines of food plants, and first he had to talk a little bit about what had been lost.
You know, you have to remember that on the White Earth Reservation and many other reservations throughout the country, you know, we went through a massive dispossession of land, language, culture, ceremony, song, dance, history, and even our children, okay? A lot of that was taken away from us in the last 100 to 150 years. So for us, it's more about just doing the work that needs to be done to revitalize so much of what was taken away during that period of massive dispossession. And yeah, there is a strength, there is a vitality, there is a spirit that goes with so much of this stuff. You know, it's about, what would you say the modern equivalent is, like praying it forward? So those seeds, that handful of seeds that represents this next crop of corn or beans or whatever it is, you know, our ancestors have been having ceremony, speaking to those seeds, speaking to that spirit that's within those seeds, speaking to the spirit that's within this land and within this water and this whole ecosystem that makes it all work together to provide this, what we call Mano Bemadasiwin, the good life. Okay? It's about unearthing that, bringing that entire structure of indigenous knowledge and belief systems forth for this revitalization, this reawakening that is going on in our community as well as so many other communities. And the seed saving is one of the important foundation blocks for that, which people can, it's like driving the stake in the ground. Here's where we start. Here's where we go forth from here and bring all these pieces back together so that we can all share, enjoy, and grow.
You know, you talked a lot about corn, but it's not just corn, right? What kind of plants are you working with besides that?
Well, there's a number of different types of indigenous beans, and that's kind of my thing, is I like the beans. I plant some corn, too. But I like working with the beans. I have one I put in this year. I call it a spirit bean. And the basic bean is this, like this off-color white, almost light tan. But there's a design on each bean. It's like a little figure. But no two are the same. It's just an amazing, amazing bean. And I look at those beans and I think, man, that's like a little spirit in each one of those. Okay? So it just makes me all happy. And it's like Noreen, you know, almost gives me chills to think about, you know, this is what I'm doing here with this particular variety. But yeah, there's beans. There's a number of different squash, sunflowers, tobacco. You know, those are the main ones that we're working with. So, I mean, if you take all the different varieties of just those basic seed groups, you know, it's pretty expansive or extensive. I guess I've never really added it up. Oh, we have this many kinds of beans or this many types of corn or this many types of squash or these many types of sunflowers. But it's a lot.
So where do you get the seeds? Do you just go around to gardeners and say, have you got old seeds that you've been saving or seeds of old varieties? Or you mentioned like corresponding with people in other areas and there's a network.
It was hard. At first it was hard. When I started looking for indigenous corn back in 1994, I asked everywhere, anybody got anything? And nobody did at that point. But, you know, I guess part of it was I wasn't asking the right people because, you know, 20 years later, people are coming and say, oh, yeah, we got this kind of corn from Red Lake, or we got this variety of corn that comes from a certain island off Leech Lake in Minnesota. So the stuff was there, the seed stock was there, but I think a lot of it had to do with just trying to build a trust with the seed keepers so that we could unlock the source.
Robert Shemek with the White Earth Land Recovery Project. Bill, this is a very interesting conference. What was your big takeaway?
That there is a lot of work going on, at an incredibly detailed scientific level on these traditional foods and how they affect people's health, how their cultivation fits into a sustainability approach. And then there's these people working at a much broader level at just trying to grow them and get other people to grow them and eat them and how good they taste and how they can be cooked and how good they are for you. So everything from these most detailed, arcane, scientific, biochemical analyses to just standing out in the field and planting the corn.
That's our Bill Thomas. Thanks for being with us today, Bill. Coming up next on Main Street, we'll get our weekly debrief on the news headlines from our news director, Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean reviews a new movie. It's Won't You Be My Neighbor? First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Air Force is privatizing water, wastewater, and electrical utilities at the Grand Forks Air Force Base and the Cavalier Air Force Station. That story now from Prairie Public's Dave Thompson.
Les Canard is deputy base civil engineer for the 219th Civil Engineer Squadron. He said it's part of an Air Force initiative to sell its utilities where possible to private firms who have more expertise and now have promised to make upgrades.
It's a great program because what it does is it allows the Air Force to maximize that utility reliability, you know, increase all that mission insurance by selling our utility systems to a private company, another company, to help us jump on maybe some innovative improvements, make some upgrades, build some resiliency into it, do some more energy assurance into it that maybe that they can do that maybe we were never allowed to do due to regulations or funding limitations.
Base Utilities Incorporated of Minot has been awarded the water and wastewater contract. It's a 50-year deal worth $285.5 million. Base Utilities has also committed to more than $10 million worth of upgrades.
We've identified some water lines that are in need of repair, some wastewater lines that are in need of repair, and they have a neat system that will hopefully do it in the less obtrusive manner possible. We've got some other issues we'd like to have monitored, so more real-time, how are our pumps working, how's our water towers working, you know, install some innovative systems that can monitor and provide real-time data that we don't have the ability to do today.
NODAC Electric Cooperative of Grand Forks got the contract for electrical service. It's $85.5 million over 50 years. NODAC will spend $1.7 million in improvements.
We've done a real good job on the electrical part of burying a lot of our undergrounds. There's still a little bit more work we want to do. Their list of things to do is a little smaller, but still stuff that we couldn't get at financially and as quickly as we needed, but they'll jump on it for us in that first 5 years.
Canard said when all is said and done, the Air Force will get what it needs at a competitive price. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And preparations are underway for a new state revenue forecast. State Budget Director Joe Morissette says it's the first preliminary forecast for the 2019-2021 biennium. Morissette says he's already been talking with Moody's, the state's revenue forecaster.
We have a meeting of the Revenue Advisory Council, which includes industry and business representatives, as well as the chairman of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees. And we meet next Monday to have a call with Moody's, discuss their initial estimates, get some feedback from the group on how they interpret that and how it lines up with their view of the economy going forward.
Morissette says once that feedback is received, it will be used to help craft that forecast.
It'll be at least a couple of weeks after that before we have final numbers. It could be 3 or so. So sometime probably preliminary forecast would be available, I would say, first week or so of August, maybe second week, something like that. We don't have a firm deadline. It just kind of depends how much discussion follows the input of the advisory group.
Governor Burgum will use that forecast to help him craft the executive budget, which will be presented to the legislature in its December organizational session. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, that wire machine says it's time to talk to Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Dave, the state budget tightening has a new ramification today. You had a report that you just filed this morning.
It certainly does. Well, there's a couple of things going on in that report. If you look at it, in that report online, there are two parts. Number one is that a lot of agencies who are, you know, getting ready to submit their budgets to the governor so he could put together the executive budget have asked for some extra time to put it together. And that's because they put this new step in that they wanted to take a look at agencies and look at collaboration and look at some kind of ways to find other ways to do things a little bit more streamlined. And agencies have taken advantage of that, but they said they need more work on the budget. So a vast majority of agencies have asked for a little extra time to get the budget in.
And these are called strategy reviews?
Right, strategy reviews, because it's all part of this idea that the governor has to reinvent government and how maybe agencies can collaborate to find ways to kind of streamline some of the things they do.
Meanwhile, in your story, you mentioned that the sales tax, which is a very important part of the general fund, is showing some optimistic direction.
It is, but here's where the interesting thing comes in to me. It's basically all in the oil patch.
Yeah.
In the four major cities, we're reporting some decline in sales. And again, you may say that that's possibly because of online sales, and we can get into that as well, because that's going to be an interesting thing, and that's going to be an X factor in the next budget.
Well, an important piece of that sales tax, though, it might have been helped by the Supreme Court ruling last
exactly
month.
Right. Now that the Supreme Court ruling, and as of October, the state tax commissioner said, okay, you online retailers, you're going to have to start collecting North Dakota sales tax. But what I find interesting, it's October when they started, and they're not going to have a lot of time to figure out how this might impact the budget. But then again, they have forecasting firms taking a look at how these potential new sales tax revenues from online purchases might help the bottom line in North Dakota.
Well, any new money is appreciated, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Danielle Webster had a story that was filed yesterday. There's a resource center that's been established in Watford City following that awful tornado.
That was terrible. Two tornadoes in 4 years.
Yeah.
Both affected man camp type places. And in Watford City, the second time, it was a man camp plus some mobile homes and plus some RV park. And there were a lot of injuries, more than two dozen injuries, and unfortunately, one infant died, a week-old infant. And that's a sad story, because we haven't had a death from a tornado in a while, and especially if you've got an infant and you've got this man camp, which is apparently outside the city limits, and you couldn't hear the tornado sirens, number one, because they were a little too far away, but number two, you had winds 120 miles per hour plus, so it was hard to hear. So you could see the damage, and the city's recovering from the damage, and they're trying to find permanent housing for some of these people, or at least temporary housing for some of these people. And the Red Cross is there in force as well.
Well, it's a reminder that some kinds of housing are very vulnerable to this kind of storm.
They certainly are.
These are outside the city limits. Maybe there's no rule that they should have some sort of shelter, but people should know where that is.
I know, and that's been fought for years in terms of, do you require a mobile home court to have a separate tornado shelter, or maybe an RV park to have a separate tornado shelter? That's been a major discussion, which kind of died down for a little while, but you might hear it come back up again, at least in local governments.
Earlier this week, Dave, Todd McDonald had a story headlined, Minnesota Company Considers Tariffs and Options. This is DigiKey.
Right, Thief River Falls.
And they apparently get a lot of stuff from China.
They do, and they're also selling a lot overseas, too. So they're worried about the double-edged sword, not only having to pay more for material that they use to manufacture, that they buy from China, but when they sell on the market, it may become less attractive because of tariffs. And they're all trying to kind of figure this whole thing out as the tariffs have been established and what has some have called a trade war has been going on.
Well, we've been talking about the price of soybeans being affected because China's
right.
such an important trading partner for North Dakota soybean farmers. But this is also a steel and aluminum issue as well. You know, those prices for those commodity goods, those manufacturing commodity goods, are also going up.
Absolutely. And that's going to affect people's bottom line. And that also might drive the cost of things up here in the United States as well.
Well, a big issue, it turns out, in the state of North Dakota, and likely on the ballot, it looks like, will be recreational marijuana, Dave.
Yes. The group that circulated the petition got several thousand more than they expected. And what's interesting, the law was changed in North Dakota so that you miss the state fair, which was always a good place to get signatures.
Yeah.
But the people for recreational marijuana got over 18,000 signatures, so they're fairly confident it's going to be on the ballot. And talking to some of the people, you had some interesting people who were in the mix supporting it. You had the people who might, you might say, the ones who might like to smoke marijuana now. But there are also a lot of libertarians. That's that libertarian streak in the Republican Party that's coming out saying, hey, what you want to do on your time is your business.
Well, it doesn't appear to be a big groundswell of opposition yet.
Not yet, but you might see law enforcement get there because marijuana is still a Schedule I drug. That's the downside risk.
Well, the fellow who's in charge of legalized North Dakota, the chairman of that group, David Owen, says that another piece of this would basically expunge the record of people who've faced a marijuana charge in the past.
Right. And he said that the expungement is kind of misunderstood because people think it's going to be just letting people out of prisons right now. Well, no. What happens is you get out of prison and you remain crime-free for 20 to 30 days, then your record is going to be sealed. And, you know, you can get student loans after that. You can open bank accounts in some cases, and you can actually do things that if you didn't have a criminal record.
Well, the interesting thing in a way about this midterm election, too, is that some issues get people to the polls. This might actually be a spur to some people to vote who might otherwise not have.
And that is another dynamic that's going to be fascinating to watch, to see how it does drive people to the polls. There are a few other measures that may drive people to the polls as well.
Well, one thing that may have driven this recreational marijuana issue is the slow walk that medical marijuana has had in North Dakota.
There has been just nothing but frustration from people who supported medical marijuana because they thought they passed it. They signed the petitions. They passed it in 2016. It should be out there right now. Well, they looked and they needed to tweak it so it fits North Dakota law. And now it looks like maybe the end of this year we might see it.
Well, they were talking about fall at one time.
Fall at one time, but I'm thinking end of the year because it's taken a little bit more time to, you know, process applications for growth centers and also for the compassion centers, the dispensaries.
Yeah, it looks like they're going to be taking those first two dispensary regions, Bismarck and Fargo. Those are open now, right?
They're open applications, I mean? But they're not open themselves
exactly.
Yet. But applications are coming in.
And then after that, it'll be Grand Forks and Williston, and then eventually they're going to have eight of these dispensaries.
That's right. It will be Williston, Dickinson, Minot, Bismarck, Devil's Lake, Jamestown, Grand Forks, and Fargo.
So we still don't know for sure when medical marijuana will be available, but the apparently it keeps getting pushed back
a little bit. I guess you can say stay tuned.
Yeah, I guess you could. Dave, I recently got my brand new Medicare card, which has a brand new number on it. Mm-hmm. And the insurance department is warning of Medicare fraud that might be connected with this change. And Danielle Webster filed a story about that earlier this week.
Right. You worry about people who call you, say, if you got your new Medicare card, we need your Social Security number to verify that. And Medicare will not call. They will not make calls. They'll contact you by snail mail or email, but will not make calls. And that's the point they wanted to get across is if you get a call, it's most likely a scam.
And if they were asking you for your Social Security number, which was on the old cards, it is not on the new cards.
That's right.
That's really dangerous if they're giving out that number. So
and a good
don't
point,
do it.
Yeah, exactly. A good point of reference. If somebody asks for your Social Security number, do not give it to them if they call you.
Yeah, hang up. Dave, earlier today you had a story that is headlined Air Force privatizing water, wastewater, and electrical utilities at the Grand Forks Air Force Base and the Cavalier site.
Right. You have a Minot firm that's going to do water and wastewater, and you see they've signed a 50-year agreement. That's going to be multi-millions of dollars, but in turn they're going to do some upgrades. And the electric company's NODAC, which is a cooperative out of Grand Forks, and they've also agreed to do some upgrades in terms of some monitoring and some bearing of lines. The concern is that the Air Force has had this philosophy. They fix it when it breaks, but they wanted to get private firms who are more versed in these things to come up with some solutions to try to anticipate trouble before it happens and try to get things ramp back up if something does happen.
Well, the Air Force is, you know, expert at flying planes and things.
It is.
Let people who deal with water, I guess.
Absolutely.
Dr. Deborah Dregseth of Dickinson State University has been appointed to Higher Education Governance Task Force. Why did that happen?
Why that happened is because that the one other person who was representing faculty from Bismarck State College has a new job and it caused some conflict of interest. She will stay on in a non-voting capacity, but they decided to put Deborah Dragseth on. She'll be a voting member, and she represents the College of, you know, the Council of College Faculties. So she has a pretty good handle on what's going on in higher education. And some of the things she's talked about on things that she wants to protect academic freedom, and she wants to make sure that you have campuses that are not going to lose their identity when they're if there are some major changes in governance.
Well, one more thing. If you're an Xcel Electric customer in the state of North Dakota, you might see a credit on your bill pretty soon.
Right, because refunds, Xcel isn't allowed a certain rate of return. It went over that, so it's going to be – that's going to reduce the bill. Plus, there are a couple other refunds that are coming down. That will reduce the bill total about $16.
Well, it's always nice to get a little money from the electric company.
It is.
All right. We check in with our news director every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave. Have a great weekend.
I will, and you too. Hey, we'll see you after vacation.
Hi, I'm Ashley Thornburg. I hope you'll join me at the North Dakota Heritage Center Thursday, July 19th, to celebrate the Oral History Project StoryCorps and their time in North Dakota, recording stories inside their iconic Airstream mobile recording booth. Meet the people behind StoryCorps and all share select stories from your friends and neighbors about the people and experiences that have shaped their lives. So celebrate StoryCorps with Prairie Public Thursday, July 19th from 6:30 to 7:30 inside the Russell Reed Auditorium at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck.
Well, it's time to go to the movies with Matt Olin. And Matt, that brassy fanfare sounds a little out of place for the movie we're going to talk about today.
Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is now playing in wide release all over the country. This is the new documentary about Fred Rogers, of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood fame, and it's directed by Morgan Neville, who recently won the Oscar for documentary feature for 20 Feet from Stardom, which was about background singers for the Rolling Stones and Sting and people like that. So this is moving. It's touching. It kind of goes through how the show started. It talks about how the sets were very cheap. It's really not a way to do good television, yet it somehow worked, I think, because of his voices and his genuineness with children. When it started in Pittsburgh on public TV in 1967, there's not a lot of new information here, I guess. I didn't expect anything new. But it is certainly well done. It's well crafted. It's well edited. You've got all the interviews with all the people you're kind of expecting to be interviewed about Fred Rogers' life, including his two sons and his widow and people that worked with him. I think what I come away with the documentary, Doug, and I think it's probably the early front runner for the Oscar documentary, I would guess. It's got all kind of the elements, I think, that the Oscar documentary jury is looking for. What comes through is, I think, how his message of, you know, kids are people, you have to talk to them, you have to be make them feel special. I'm not sure that it is translated into modern television. You know what I'm saying, Doug? I think there's a lot of television out there that's geared toward kids that isn't what Fred Rogers wanted it to be. Now, when you get outside the PBS system, that's really the case with a lot of children's television.
Oh, yes.
And you see in the documentary how Rogers did not like that kind of television. I think a lot of people think there's room for both. That's really interesting, I think, is his views on television and how it was kind of misused, I think, through the years.
I think he found a lot of children's television, modern children's television, to be too violent.
Yes, he did. That is talked about in the documentary about how much of it was too violent. Has there been an impact on kids with that? I mean, we can debate that forever and ever. But I think what comes off in the documentary is this is how he was in real life. This isn't some act he put on. He went into the dressing room and he was some guy throwing stuff. That wasn't him. This is actually who he was. And I think it would have been difficult to fake that on television. It comes off as genuine. This is who he was. He was really this good of a person. And no matter what people try to find to criticize him about, he kind of maintained it above the fray.
Well, I have seen this documentary, so this is one of those rare times when you and I have actually been to the same movie about the same time. And I was very impressed with it, particularly the way the show started, because that was back in the days when pie in the face was sort of considered children's entertainment. Mm-hmm. Before now, we've got superheroes and, you know, all that kind of slapstick and cartoons and things like that, too.
He was very radical. I think that's what the message of the documentary is what he was doing was radical at the time. and it was very and it was followed very closely by Sesame Street and Electric Company and shows like this. Mr. Rogers came a couple years before Sesame Street. And you really get the alter egos of Fred Rogers. Daniel the Tiger is talked about as that's really Fred Rogers as a boy. And then sometimes when Fred Rogers would want something or get a little more stern, that was King Friday. So you have all these alter egos of him on the set. And that was interesting as well to me. There was a couple things I was hoping for a little bit more. It's a great film. I love it just like you do, Doug. But there's an early soundbite. I can't remember who the man's name is, where he talks about, I really wonder, was his impact that great? Because it doesn't seem like it is when you watch children's television. And then he talks about that, and it never goes anywhere from there. And then at the end, Doug, there is this faction out there that criticized Fred Rogers because of the every kid is special just because you are you. And this is the participation ribbon, participation trophy criticism of society that every kid gets a participation ribbon. And so there was some of that. They show brief clips of people saying, did Fred Rogers ruin an entire generation, which he didn't. That's ridiculous. I think the criticism is ridiculous. But I would have liked to have seen a longer soundbite from someone who really believes this. That would have been interesting to throw in just to kind of get that perspective. Instead, what they do is they have someone who's a Fred Rogers fan, explain what the criticism was. So maybe a little bit more on that would have been kind of interesting to give it more of a dual side to the documentary, because everyone interviewed, you know, loves him, and that's great. Most people do. But there was this camp out there, Doug, that thought that he told all kids they were special and they didn't have to earn anything to be special. That's kind of an interesting – I don't agree with that, but it's interesting.
Well, I was entering adulthood when the show started on the air. So for me, the Fred Rogers neighborhood was sort of him putting on the sweater and then mm-hmm. I was someplace else. What I was really touched by in this documentary was when he dealt with some very difficult yes. issues like war, like assassination, and treated kids who were certainly seeing this stuff everywhere, but who was talking to them about this. And that was, I thought, very deep, very moving.
That is the most interesting thing about his show, is he did talk about the Bobby Kennedy assassination. He shared a foot pool with Officer Clemens, who yes. was black.
Yes.
And that was radical for the time, that you can put your feet in this cool water on this hot day with me and I don't care. So that was very radical at the time. And I think what he was very good at was talking to kids about their feelings, and that if a toy loses its ear in the laundry, that's an important event to a kid. It might not seem important to you or I, Doug, but it is to that child. And that's what he was very good at. He was a master at it. And really, there hasn't been anybody like him since. There really – who is the Fred Rogers now? I suppose there's people out there like him, but he truly was a visionary. I don't think he thought he was a visionary. Maybe he did near the end. But this is well worth your time. It's very interesting. It moves fast. There's not really any kind of crazy new techniques that Neville uses in terms of documentary filmmaking. There's not that going on, but it's definitely worth a look.
Well, it had a very big audience when I saw it at the Fargo Theater, so obviously it's catching on. It's getting attention.
There are certain documentaries like the Al Gore documentaries that do have an audience out there that can make it a box office hit for a documentary. This is one of those for sure.
All right, so a thumb up
yeah,
for
yes.
this one.
Oh, yes.
And let me put mine up, too. Well, my Oscar trivia question is about documentaries. The Academy Award for Documentary Feature is an award, of course, for documentary films. What was the first time this was awarded, and it was probably not bestowed as a documentary award in this case, but as a special award, very quickly became a documentary award? What year?
Around 37, wasn't it, Doug? Something like that?
It's later than that. It's 1941.
42. Okay, I was going to say 42 is my second guess. And they were kind of war documentaries typically that won those early awards.
They were. Both of them were. Kukan right. and Target for Tonight.
Yes.
All right. A little bit of history. We finally stumped Matt O'Lean.
At least I was in the right area code.
We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 13th. In 1853, the U.S. Army's Topographic Bureau set out to find the best transcontinental passages across the American West and scout routes for a railroad. The necessity of a passage from east to west coasts was growing more and more apparent as people headed to California in search of gold. Five survey teams were formed between 1853 and 1855, from Oklahoma to Los Angeles, St. Louis to San Francisco, Texas to San Diego, San Diego to Seattle, and St. Paul to the Puget Sound. Beyond geographical analysis, the U.S. government saw an opportunity to document and collect data about the largely unexplored middle of the country. The teams recorded native plants and animals, depicted scenery, and captured the lives of the native peoples. Artists were hired to document the journey, capturing the events by camera or by hand. The most prolific artist of the Pacific Railroad Survey was John Mick Stanley. Stanley accompanied the Isaac Stevens survey team from St. Paul to the Pacific Coast, creating several pieces featuring North Dakota. Stanley was largely a self-taught artist, studying portraiture briefly in upstate New York and Detroit before striking out west to make his career. His style imitates another artist-explorer who came before him, George Catlin. Like Catlin, Stanley is known for his western scenes and portraits of the Native American tribes. Stanley traveled often to California and Oregon in the 1840s and 1850s, creating over 150 portraits of the Native peoples. Stanley's North Dakota scenes were created in July of 1853. On this date, the artist would likely have been found sketching on a hill, taking field notes, or preparing for the formal finished pieces he would later make once their journey ended. He created scenes of trade at Fort Union and pristine landscapes of river valleys and rolling grasslands, capturing moments soon lost to the oncoming railroad. Stanley's work with the Stevens Survey was published by the United States War Department from 1855 to 1860. He contributed more works than any other artists on the surveys. However, most of these works have not survived due to a fire at the Smithsonian in 1865, where his works were on display. Stanley's artwork reflects many 19th century misconceptions and stereotypes. However, they also portray a nation defining itself in a time of great change. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Maria Witham. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Monday on Main Street, deep in the heart of the sauerkraut triangle, people know their bratwurst from their bockwurst, their strudel from streusel, and the polka from the two-step. So on Monday, we will share a StoryCorps excerpt that features Victor Schwann. He's been playing the accordion for 73 years, and he visited the StoryCorps mobile booth in Bismarck with his friend Harvey Schilling to talk about getting his start. You can do that, too. Just go online to prairiepublic.org and make an appointment with StoryCorps, which is in the state through the month of July, to gather personal accounts, personal histories, if you will. And Sunday morning, if you're up at 10 o'clock, and I think most of us are, you can check out Main Street Weekend at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.